Chapter 10. About 8 or 9 in the morning, I was come to the same seat of the yellow metal from which I viewed the world upon the evening of my arrival. I thought of my hasty conclusions upon that evening and could not refrain from laughing bitterly at my confidence. Here was the same beautiful scene, the same abundant foliage, the same splendid palaces and magnificent ruins, the same silver river running between its fertile banks. The gay robes of the beautiful people moved hither and thither among the trees, and there was some bathing in exactly the same place where I had saved Weena. Then suddenly gave me a keen stab of pain. Like blots upon the landscape rose the cupolas, ways of to the underworld. I understood now that all the beauty of the overworld people covered. Very pleasant was their day, as pleasant as the day of cattle in the field. Like the cattle, they knew of no enemies and provided against no needs, and their end was the same. I grieved to think how brief the dream of human intellect had been. It had committed suicide. It had set itself steadfastly toward comfort and ease, a balanced society with security and permanency as its watchword. It had attained its hopes to come to this last age. Once life and property must have reached almost absolute safety. The rich had been assured of his wealth and comfort, the toiler assured of his life and work. No doubt that in this perfect world there had been no unemployment problem, no social question left unsolved, and a great quiet had followed. It was a law of nature we overlooked, that intellectual versatility is the compensation for change, danger, and trouble. An animal perfectly in harmony with its environment is a perfect mechanism. Nature never appeals to intelligence until habit and instinct are useless. There is no intelligence where there is no change and no need of change. Only those animals partake of intelligence that have to meet a huge variety of needs and dangers. So as I see it, the upper world man had drifted towards his feeble prettiness and the underworld to mere mechanical industry. But that perfect state had lacked one thing even more for the mechanical perfection, absolute permanency. Apparently, as time went on, the feeding of the underworld, however it was affected, had become disjointed. Mother Necessity, who had staved off for a few thousand years, came back again. She began below. The underworld being, in contact with machinery, which however perfect still needs some thought, outside habit, had probably retained, perforce, some more initiative, if less of every other human character, than the upper. And when all other meat failed them, they turned to what old habit had heretofore forbidden. So as to say it, in my view of the world of the 802,007 and 1, it may have been as wrong an explanation as moral wit could invent. It was the thing shaped itself to me as that I give to you. After the fatigue, excitement, and terrors of the past days, in spite of my grief, the seat and the tranquil view with the warm sunlight were very pleasant. I was tired and sleepy, and soon my theorizing passed into dozing. Catching myself at that, I took myself one hint and spread myself upon the turf as I had long, refreshing sleep. I awoke a little before sunsetting, how I felt safe against being caught napping by the Morlocks, and stretched myself. I came on a downhill towards the White Sphinx and had my crowbar in one hand and the other played with matches in my pocket. And now came upon a most unexpected thing. As I approached the pedestal of the Sphinx, I found the bronze valves were open. They were slid down into grooves, and I stopped short before them. I hesitated to enter, and within was a small apartment, and there was a small place in the corner of the time machine. I saw the small levers in my pocket, so there, after my elaborate perjurations for the sledge of the White Sphinx, was a meek surrender. I threw my iron bar away, almost sorry not to use it. A sudden thought came into my head as I stopped towards the portal. For once at least, I grasped the mental operations of the Morlocks. Suppressing a strong inclination to laugh, I strapped through the bronze frame and opened to the time machine. I was surprised to find it had been carefully oiled and cleaned, and I suspected that since the Morlocks had even partially taken it to pieces, trying in their dim way to grasp its purpose. As I stood examining it, I found the pleasure in mere touch of its contrivance, the one thing I expected to happen. The bronze pedal suddenly slid up and struck with a frame with a clang, and I was in the dark trap, so the Morlocks thought. At that, I chuckled gleefully. I could hear their murmuring laughter as they came toward me. Very calmly, I tried to strike the match. I had only to fix the levers and depart like a ghost. But I had overlooked the one thing. The matches were the abominable kind that light only on the box. You can imagine all my calm vanished. The little brutes were close upon me. One touched me. One was sweeping a blow in the dark at them with the levers and began to scramble in the saddle of the machine. Then I came upon one hand and another, and I simply fight against their persistent fingers for my levers, and at the same time I feel for the studs for which these fitted, and one indeed almost gave way from me as I slipped from my hand. I had to butt in the dark with my head. I could hear one of the skulls ring to recover it. It was a nearer thing than a fight in the forest. I think it was a last scramble. But at last the lever was fitted and pulled over, and clanging hands slipped from me, and the darkness presently fell. From my eyes I found myself the same gray light and tumult I had always described.